Again, thank you for coming, and thanks to the Quantum Gravity Group for inviting me. I want to tell you about some results that we've been working on over the last 4 to 5 years, collaboration with Rodolfo Gambini and Miguel Campiglia at the University of the Republic in Uruguay, and Javier Olmedo, who is a postdoc at LSU now. This is the plan of the talk. We're going to review some earlier work on spherically symmetric vacuum quantum spacetimes. We're going to review a technique to do physics on such scenario. We'll discuss how to construct quantum vacua for fields living on quantum spacetimes, how to get Hawking radiation, how to do the Casimir effect, how to treat self-gravitating shells, and a little bit of look into what's going on now, in particular, renormalization and the use of conformal loop quantum gravity. There's a lot to go through here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to concentrate on transmitting the central ideas. I'm not going to give you all the derivations in detail, because otherwise it would be too boring and too dry. If you want to discuss details, I'll be happy to do things in private later. So the main thing, starting point, is that in 2013, we found, in closed form, the space of physical states corresponding to spherically symmetric vacuum spacetimes and loop quantum gravity. It's essentially the quantum Schwarzschild solution. We have the solution to all the constraints of loop quantum gravity in the spherically symmetric vacuum case. Now, that is like sort of candy for people doing quantum gravity. It's something rare, right? We never had that in any other system before, with the possible exception of cosmologies, where things are much simpler. But then it raises the question, how do you actually ask questions of physical interest in this arena? Because in the space of physical states, that is, the states that are annihilated by all the constraints, the only quantities you can ask questions about are Dirac observables. And normally, we're not accustomed to phrasing physics questions in terms of Dirac observables. So we'll have to do a little bit of work to translate the questions we normally are interested in into Dirac observables. And the idea is to represent what we want to study, for instance, the matter part of the Hamiltonian constraint, if you want to study the evolution of a field, as a parameterized Dirac observable. And so I'll explain you a little bit what that technique is about, because then you can represent what you want as a Dirac observable in this space, and you can do physics there. We're going to choose quantum states that are very peaked around a Schwarzschild space-time, so states that approximate semi-classical solutions very well. We're going to take the expectation value of the matter Hamiltonian on the gravitational states, and the resulting quantum-corrected Hamiltonian we're going to quantize with traditional FOP techniques. We will use this to compute the Hawking radiation and also the Casimir effect, and we'll also talk what we're going for. We haven't done it yet, the back reaction of the Hawking radiation. If you want, the main take-home message is that the quantum background space-time acts as a lattice discretization for your field theory. It naturally regulates the field theory and eliminates its infinities, but otherwise it just changes, not in important ways, the traditional picture of quantum field theory on curved spacetime. So we're making contact, if you want, between quantum field theory and curved spacetime and quantum gravity in the context of loop quantum gravity.
So from the geometric sector, this is not quantum mechanical.
The geometric sector is full quantum gravity in spherical symmetry vacuum.
So but it means it's quantum. It's not quantum field theory.
No, it's full quantum gravity. It's loop quantum gravity.
But I have imposed spherical symmetry exactly.
I imposed spherical symmetry, and then I quantize. And I solve the constraints of the resulting system. Yeah.
But why is it not? Why is it a quantum field theoretic space? I don't see.
No, it's apparently a quantum field theoretical space when you start, because you have spatial dependence in the variables now. So it's MIDI superspace, so to speak.
So a radio dependence.
Right,
so
right.
One plus one dimension.
Right.
One plus one dimension.
I mean, at the end of the day, we know that the field theoretical content is moot because it's just a Schwarzschild.
Yeah, it's
right.
One plus one.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about that. Again, I'm not going to give all the details of this, but just give you the general ideas. So What we were able to notice is that if you rescale and combine the constraints, so one problem that you have, of course, when you do 1+1 dimensional quantum gravity, even in this simple context, is that the constraint algebra is not really algebra anymore. You have structure functions. Okay, so we don't know in general how to treat that with the Dirac method. So that's your first obstruction. So this is not as simple as it sounds. But what we noted is that if you rescale and combine the constraints, you can turn their algebra into a Lie algebra for this system. And then you can apply the Dirac quantization technique, and we actually solve in closed form the space of physical states. To give you an idea, as we were talking with Renata, you first reduce to spherical symmetry. So of all the Ashtikar variables, you're left with two canonical pairs, one along the radial direction, a triad and sort of spin connection along the radial direction, and one along the transverse direction. Okay, so there's four phase space variables. If you want to know what these are, or you don't know about loop quantum gravity, they're simply related to the traditional metric variables through these relations. So if you want, you could say, forget about Ashtikar variables. I'm just taking the traditional quantization and just using some new variables there to describe them. The kinematical states here are given by one-dimensional spin networks, okay? So you have edges, you have vertices, and along the edges, you can compute holonomies of your radial connection because it's a true connection. But the transverse variable is not a connection anymore, it's a scalar field. And therefore, what you do is you do one of these point holonomies where you exponentiate the variable like if it were a holonomy, but notice this one has an integral because this is a real holonomy along the radial direction, this one is not. So we represent that by insertions at the vertices. This is the standard way of treating scalar variables in sort of loop type quantization. A basis of physical states is given by a graph, a tower of integers associated with the valences of the spin networks along the linear direction, and a value of the ADM mass, which appears through an integration by parts of the constraints, and it's a Dirac observable. Again, as I mentioned, we were able to find this space of physical states in closed form, so I can give you explicitly what's the form of this. I don't have it on the slide because it wouldn't add too much. And one can choose states that approximate Schwarzschild very well in the regions of low curvature, but what we notice is that the singularity is eliminated. The region where the singularity used to be gets replaced by a region that, unless you fine-tune things, is a region of high curvature and high fluctuations of the curvature. And in fact, the theory tunnels through that region into another region of space-time deep inside the black hole.
Yeah. So does that mean that if you choose the states right, you can eliminate the singularity, but if you don't, then you don't eliminate it?
No. What I'm saying is if you choose generic states, the singularity is eliminated via a region of high curvature, high fluctuations in the curvature, therefore not well approximated by a classical spacetime. If you wish to fine-tune things, you can make the fluctuation small and just have a high curvature there, but that's like a sort of fine-tuned state that you wouldn't expect.
So generically it goes away?
Generically it goes away. It always goes away with a region with high fluctuations of the curvature. You can fine-tune to make the fluctuation small if you want. I don't know why you want to do that, but it can be done.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you can use a Hamiltonian constraint or some combination of that to solve for the mu labels you had before.
Exactly.
And you left with the K labels.
With K labels.
And the Diffeo constraints are basically just the usual.
The Diffeo are group average.
Over group average.
Yeah.
And you end up also with a state space which is unexpected, unexpected.
Yeah.
Which is much bigger than one would get.
So what I would like to do, so this seems to have quantum degrees of freedom that are not there in the classical theory. In the classical theory, the system has 0 degrees of freedom, or 1 if you want, 1 mechanical at infinity, which is M. So this has no quantum degrees of freedom. So what would
can I ask about your state space of the graphs? They are just consist what of just a bunch of vertices?
Right, where you have vertices. And k's, the valences of the horizontal direction, and a number, which is the ADM mass, which parameter.
But they're all finite or what? But in principle,
sure.
your radial line is infinite or one.
Well, yeah, you have to worry about infinity. So we just take a finite one and look at a chunk of space-time, because otherwise you'll have to impose fall-off conditions and there'll be technical details there.
So just a bunch of edges
right.
with certain multiplicities.
Right. Okay, so we want to put quantum fields to live on this state. And we're not going to study back reaction yet, so it's okay for the combined system to assume that the states are a direct product of the states for gravity that we have here and the matter states. And the problem we encounter here is these are physical states, so the only things you can represent on them are Dirac observables. And so we're going to have to do something to the Hamiltonian constraint of matter to represent it as a Dirac observable. The technique we're going to use is this parameterized Dirac observable technique, and not everyone might be familiar with it, so I'll review it a little bit. So this is a technique that is really cool, that allows you to associate Dirac observables with quantities that are not gauge invariant, okay? So that might be surprising, because one thinks that Dirac observables are associated with only with things that are gauge invariant. So this is what, by the way, Carlo calls evolving constants of the motion. It's a little bit more general because he normally was thinking in the context of mechanical systems, but can be generalized to field theories without any problem. So say you have a bunch of Dirac observables that are functions of a parameter. They have vanishing Poisson brackets with your constraints. That's the definition of a Dirac observable. And let's impose that when the parameter takes the value of one of the canonical coordinates, the Dirac observable becomes one of the canonical coordinates. So essentially, the essence of this is you're asking what's the value of a canonical coordinate when another one takes a certain value. And although neither of these values is gauge invariant, their relationship is. That's what the Dirac observable is. And so if you want to see an example, take the relativistic particle. This is your constraint, the mass shell, in one dimension to make it simple. So this is ordinary momentum. This is the momentum associated with time. That's the parameterized relativistic particle. There are two Dirac observables that you can write. P obviously commutes with this. And this other one you can check commutes with that. And in terms of both, you can build this observable that depends on a parameter, T, such that when T equals Q and Q naught, this thing takes the value Q. So it's doing that job up there. And so these are the evolving constants of the motion. And what is perhaps well less known is that there are mechanisms for representing gauge-dependent quantities via Dirac observables. For instance, I have just associated a Dirac observable with a completely gauge-dependent quantity Q. How does it work? Well, the thing is, this Dirac observable doesn't have a well-defined value because it has this parameter in it that is free, okay? That parameter represents the gauge dependence of the quantity. It's only when you fix that parameter that you have a fixed value for your quantity, you are in a given gauge, okay? So the parameter that appears in these Dirac observables represents your ignorance about the fact that the quantity is gauge dependent, really. It's not a Dirac observable, okay? But formally, you can treat it like one because it commutes with the constraints. So you can certainly represent it in the space of physical states. So for instance, in terms of these techniques, we can find a Dirac observable associated with a triad along the radial direction, okay? The way it works is it basically picks out, you define an operator that picks out the value of the k in there and associates that as an eigenvalue of ex. So what's going on here? As we were talking with Bianca, we're doing group averaging in the radial direction to solve the diffeomorphism constraints. Now, look at my fingers, because in one dimension, diffeomorphisms do this. They can't do this, okay? So the relative order of the k's along the radial direction is invariant under diffeomorphisms. I can't move a k from here to here, okay? If this k is before the other one, it will always be. So in fact, in the order of that tower of k's that we have there is invariant information. And since the k's are the eigenvalues of ex, there is, you're capturing in here the gauge invariant information associated with the ex, which is the order of the k's, not where the k's lie physically. That's gauge dependent, depends on your radial coordinate. And that is picked up by this functional parameter z here. So this is a function of x, and depending the value of z, the functional type of function I choose, is where the relative k is going to be along the radial direction. But still, there is diffeo-invariant content in the values of the case. Since we can represent the triads, we can certainly represent the metric as well. So we can write a quantity that is a parameterized Dirac observable. This depends on two functional parameters. One is this function z that enters through ex, and the other functional parameter is k phi. K phi, ex, z represents sort of your choice of radial coordinate, where do you decide to assign the points. K represents your slicing. Okay, so I chose here to write, for instance, gtx, because if I take k equals 0, gtx is 0. That would correspond to a Schwarzschild-like slicing. Whereas if I choose k non-zero, gtx is non-zero, and I could incorporate things like Eddington-Finkelstein or other horizon-penetrating slicings. So now that we know how to write the metric as an operator, something that I can put a hat on, because everything here is well defined now as a quantum operator acting on the space of physical states, I can start to ask questions about, for instance, what happens to a scalar field. By the way, all this has been generalized to Reissner-Nordström. I spare you the details. Again, the metric can be represented as a parameterized Dirac observable, and the singularity is removed, like in the vacuum case. And the interesting thing here is that this opens no perspectives on the Cauchy horizons. As you know, the usual story is, this is the diagram, Penrose diagram of Reissner-Nordström. Here is the singularity that now gets eliminated. And here there's a Cauchy horizon, meaning that if you and a friend depart and you live your life outside the black hole and your friend falls inside the black hole, conceivably, you could shine a flashlight on your friend. Your friend could try to do the same, but as your friend gets through the horizon, the light won't get out anymore. But the thing is, you live your whole life up here, up to sort of future infinity. So by the time you reached up there, you've shown an infinite amount of light on your friend, and you fried your friend in there, you see, because your friend received an infinite amount of energy. That heuristic argument suggests that this surface is probably unstable under perturbation. So if you throw in perturbations of any sort, that surface is unstable. That's sort of the instability of the Cauchy horizon. The new twist here is that because we're now in a quantum spacetime and it has discreteness in it, when you shine light on your friend, not all your light reaches your friend, but part of it backscatters off the lattice of the quantum spacetime and sort of falls across the Cauchy horizon. So that could open new perspectives in the sense that it doesn't have to be an infinite buildup of energy there. It could be something different. We haven't studied this in detail yet, but it's a new possibility. So let me show you how to put a quantum scalar field in the space-time. So we now take the Hamiltonian of the scalar field, and you can recognize it here, p squared for the scalar field, phi prime squared, and because we're in spherical symmetry, there's also p phi prime term. And the quantities that are in front, I can write them all using these techniques as parameterized Dirac observables that know how to act on the space of physical states. And here I give you the action of these quantities on the space of physical states. So I can now take an expectation value of this quantity on my gravitational exact quantum states, and I'm going to be left with a classical expression for the Hamiltonian of a scalar field that has quantum corrections from the quantum space-time in it, that it's living in. And what I can do now is I can take that classical expression for the scalar field with the quantum corrections due to the quantum space-time and quantize that using Fock techniques, okay? So that's what we're gonna do. A couple of comments. The spacing on the lattice has a condition given by the quantization of the areas of symmetry of the problem. And it says that in the exterior of the black hole, it has to go at least as L Planck squared divided by 4gm. So if you're looking at a large black hole, this is really, really tiny. That means that you can have sub-Planckian separation of the lattice points, and the discrete equations that we have are really excellent approximations of the continuum equations, at least at energies lower than the Planck energy. And so most calculations actually follow like those in the continuum. You can proceed to define modes, and in terms of them, you can define creation annihilation operators, and you can compute the vacuum. We have done the calculation of the Unruh, Bulwer, and Hartle-Hawking vacua, and they resemble those in the continuum with very, very small corrections. The main change that is that certain trans-Planckian modes that would have wavelengths smaller than this lattice spacing are suppressed. You're living in a lattice, so you don't have arbitrarily high frequencies. And that implies that physical quantities that might diverge at the horizons, like the stress energy tensor, remain finite. And this may have implications for future attempts to do back reaction calculations. I'm not going to show you all three of these. I'll show you one. All the others are very, very similar. So if you go back to your Hamiltonian, quantum corrected by the quantum spacetime in the background, it turns out that you can write it actually as an ordinary Klein-Gordon equation with what it has become to be called in this jargon a dressed metric, the dressing coming from the quantum spacetime. And for instance, this equation, you can go and try to do the Bolwer modes. The Bolwer modes are done in terms of the tortoise coordinates. The tortoise coordinate can be accommodated in our framework through choosing a particular functional parameter in the Dirac observable associated with E. Okay, remember this functional parameter there that one could choose? Well, you can choose it in such a way that your coordinate is the tortoise coordinate, and this is the quantum equation that would define the modes for your scalar field. The spacing on the lattice is point dependent, but if you're interested in the Bolwer modes, that is done asymptotically, and that when you go asymptotically at infinity, the spacing tends to become uniform, and the modes become the ordinary modes in sort of, we're far away, we're at infinity, so the potential of Schwarzschild is gone to zero, and therefore the modes become the ordinary modes of quantum field theory in curved spacetime. But the important difference is the dispersion relation is a dispersion relation of the lattice, okay? So the dispersion relation for the lattice, if you expand the costs, you'll get omega equals k for small values of k, but for large frequencies, this differs from the dispersion relation in the continuum. So trans-Planckian modes are heavily suppressed due to the discreteness of the spin network state, and there are no arbitrary frequency trans-Planckian modes. The dispersion relation is modified in a subluminal way, so it doesn't affect the horizon structure. And the physical quantities don't have singularities, like, for instance, the expectation value of stress energy tensor. You can do similar calculations for the unruined Hartle-Hawking vacuum, and I'll immediately point you to the reference where we did it. One has to be a little bit more careful there, because in the unruined Hartle-Hawking vacua, one uses slicings where the position of the points of the spin network become time dependent, okay? And so this whole construction that was relatively straightforward here becomes more complicated because your equation becomes discretized on a lattice that is time dependent. There's no problem, you can do it, it's just messier, and therefore I'm not gonna show it here. You can look it up in this reference. Now that we have the modes for the scalar field living on a quantum spacetime, we can try to see if we can get the Hawking radiation. The usual way of getting the Hawking radiation is via the Bogoliubov coefficients between the in and out states with the modes given by expressions like this in spherical symmetry and using the sort of exponentiated variables related to the unruh vacuum. If you follow most calculations in books or papers, they all end up with this expression here where they take the number operator in the out states and they evaluate it on the vacuum on the in states. So obviously, you take the number operator in the in states and evaluate it on the in states, you get zero. You take the out one on the out ones, you get zero, because you're doing the out one on the in ones is when you get something non-trivial, and that's what the Hawking radiation is. And you end up with an expression like this that has these gray body factors in front and so on. But I call your attention to this little I epsilon that they have to put there. And again, this is not our calculation. This is present in all calculations you find for Hawking radiation. So this is the calculation of quantum field theory in curved spacetime. Everything is continuous. But they have to put an I epsilon there because they have a z there and the integral over z blows up. Okay. When we do the same calculation on a quantum spacetime, this gets replaced by a sum. And this z never goes through zero. So because z has to satisfy this condition because of the quantization of the area, the singularity here is eliminated, and you can proceed with the calculation without any sort of regularization. And remarkably, the expression you get is the same that these people, the Milwaukee group, had found using an ad hoc discretization. They had said, look, quantum gravity ought to discretize space-time. Let's try a discretization of space-time and see how it changes the calculation of the Hawking radiation. They got an expression that is the same that one we get, and so from there on we can copy the rest of their paper and get a correction to the expression of the Hawking radiation. This is less trivial than it sounds, because they had actually tried several different discretizations and only found one that actually got the right result. So it's kind of nice that the one that we have, that we didn't pick by hand, is the one that arises naturally, is the one that seemed to work for them. Let me talk a little bit.
How do I understand that? That's the corrected thing at the bottom, right?
Yeah.
How do I understand that at small omega? Does it cancel out?
The omega here is typically considered to be typical for a black hole, and it's done for large black holes. Okay, so it has a sort of range of values that is peaked. So it's not supposed to work for infrared, very, very low omega.
Okay. So I can't believe that for tiny omega.
Right. So I was giving a talk about all this in a mixed audience that wasn't just quantum gravity people. And there was a condensed matter experimentalist that asked, well, can you compute something that can be measured here? And that was a tricky question, because we were looking at free fields living on a quantum space-time is a free field at the end of the day, and there are not that many things you can compute for free fields, right? So I gave that answer, and he said, well, certainly you can compute the Casimir effect with a free field. So we took up this person's suggestion, and we studied the Casimir effect. So what's going to happen here? We're going to take the same field we were taking before, living in a quantum space-time, and we're not going to put two shells, okay, surrounding the black hole, far away, very far away, so we're essentially where the field is flat. And we're going to study the quantum field between the shells and see if we can get the Casimir effect. Okay? So what we need to do is we need to compute the stress energy tensor of the field between the shells. And this is where we had promised you that this thing usually blows up. In our case, it's going to be finite. We take the modes of the scalar field, but now we need to impose Dirichlet boundary conditions on the two shells. That's what the whole Casimir effect is about. Okay, this is a little bit unrealistic because we're doing it for a scalar field, and I don't know what material you would put that would impose Dirichlet boundary conditions for a scalar field, but if you have an electromagnetic field, certainly you can put, you know, pieces of metal, and it will do the same job. So when you impose the Dirichlet boundary conditions, these get modified a little bit, they get messier, but you have the modes. And this is for a spherical sector going from a given radius to a given length. And again, we have the dispersion relation of the lattice as we had before. And to compute the expectation value of the stress energy tensor, we use a technique that is rather common with the Green's function. So you take the Green's functions built out of these modes that we have here, and you compute the derivatives to get the terms that you need for the stress energy tensor. And what you get is the following. So the way we set up the calculation is we have the two plates that we are interested in studying. And then to avoid infrared and other issues, we put two plates down there far away, okay? Far away from the horizon, this one, far away from this one there. So everything is far away from the horizon to begin with. This one is far away from this one, and this one is far away from that one. And we compute the energy of this whole system, okay? So we integrate from here to here, from here to here, and from here to here, the T00. And then if I check how this quantity depends on L, the separation of the plates, and take the derivative with respect to L, that is the force, okay? Variation of energy is force. And so, remarkably, this is all finite, and when you compute the derivative, you get the usual results for the Casimir effect. However, compared to the usual calculation, this calculation is considerably cleaner. The usual calculation of the Casimir effect, at least by these techniques, there are a gazillion ways of computing the Casimir effect, and different techniques lead to different problems. But at least if you try to do the calculation this way, using quantum field theory on curve or flat space-time, you have infinities, and you need to regularize, and you need to renormalize. Here, I just computed the energy. Everything came out finite, and you get the right result. Okay, so that's kind of nice. no regularization or renormalization is needed. By the way, this is the correct result, including the numerical coefficient. And if you repeat the calculation just for this S mode, okay, so we had included all the modes of the field. Our background is spherically symmetric, but we included all possible modes for the scalar field. If you just keep the spherical modes of the field, you get the right 1+1 dimensional result as well. So this is fairly encouraging because people had said for many years that, you know, quantum spacetimes were going to cure the problems of quantum field theory. And here you see first evidence that that is happening. This is more recent stuff, only finished weeks ago. We were able to extend the framework now to non-vacuum situations, considering self-gravitating shells, massless shells, shells that move at the speed of light. So the Hamiltonian is the same as we had originally in the theory, but now you have these terms with thetas and deltas that represent your shell. So there are new direct observables associated with the problem now, having to do with the mass of the shell, not just the whole mass of the spacetime, and the position, the starting point at Scry from where the shell was launched. And remarkably, a redefinition of the constraints like the one we did in vacuum, again, yields an abelian Hamiltonian, and therefore an algebra of constraints that is a Lie algebra, and you can actually proceed to do its quantization as we did before. One can carry out the quantization of all the operators in the same space of states considered before, the tensor space of a square tensor, the space of square integral functions to represent the shell variables, p and the position of the shell. This is the canonically conjugate momentum to the position of the shell. At the moment, we do not know how to find the physical space of states in closed form, so we are a step back with respect to where we were in vacuum. It's conceivable that one could find it. Dynamics of shells are relatively simple. When you start adding matters to the system, by the way, it starts getting really complicated. For instance, if you just consider spherically symmetric gravity coupled to a scalar field, you can form black holes. You can do the chop trick phenomenon. So the dynamics there is devilishly complicated. And my guess is we'll never be able to solve the quantum theory in closed form for that system. But shells are simpler. Shells essentially always collapse. If they can get, you let them move inside, eventually they get inside the Schwarzschild radius and collapse, okay? So the dynamics is considerably simpler with respect to, say, for instance, scalar field. So there's a chance that we might be able to find the physical state, space of states in closed form, but we haven't been able to do it yet. What we have been able to do is we have a Hamiltonian constraint that is well-defined on our kinematical space of states. The operator is well-defined, just like it was in the vacuum. And we can also find well-defined quantum expressions for the Dirac observables of the model. And we can proceed to build the components of the metric as parameterized Dirac observables acting on the kinematical space of states. So there's a big question mark about this whole procedure from now on. That is, what if the physical space of states at the end of the day turns out not to be, like in the vacuum case, the same sort of subset of the kinematical space of states. Generically, one knows that when you solve constraints, you obtain distributions, and therefore it's sort of miraculous for the vacuum case that the physical space of states is contained within the kinematical space of states. It might not be the case here, but assuming it is, we have now quantum expressions for the Dirac observables. We can represent them on the kinematical space of states and study the metric. And what we find is we can build states that approximate very well, follow the shell very well. It crosses the horizon. It forms a black hole. And when it reaches the point where the singularity used to be, it just keeps going because there's no singularity. Again, this is not as sort of ironclad as a vacuum case, because I don't know if when we actually solve the constraints, that this will persist, but there is an indication that sort of we have a model for collapsing shells that form a black hole. Another weakness of this calculation is that since we're doing canonical quantum gravity, we can't change topology. And of course, when you form a black hole, you change topology. So what we have to do here is we have to assume from the outset that we have a space-time that where r equals 0 continues into another region just like it does when there is a black hole, even though now we're talking about flat space there, okay? So that's rather artificial, but it's a weakness of the canonical treatment that cannot handle well situations with topology change. So in spite of these shortcomings, so if you don't like that, you can say, sorry, we don't know how to treat the case of a shell that forms a black hole. But certainly we can treat the case of a shell that falls on top of a black hole. Because if I already had a black hole, then the topology is the one that we had originally in the vacuum theory, and the shell will just move through there and go through where the singularity used to be. The question mark is on, if I form a black hole, what kind of topology I end up with there, I don't know. This quantum spacetime, by the way, opens the possibility of doing back reaction calculations. You ask, why did you go to the shell? Why don't you just take your eternal black hole, where you have Hawking radiation, study the back reaction of that? Well, if you try to do that, of course, you run into problems, because an eternal black hole has an infinite amount of Hawking radiation, because it's been there forever, radiating forever, and never sort of decaying. And so everything becomes ill-defined. In order to do back reaction calculations, you need a background that actually starts from nothing, forms a black hole, and then the Hawking radiation turns on, and then you'll be able to do the back reaction. Well, we now do have such a background with a collapsing shell, and it opens the possibility of doing calculations of Hawking radiation. Let me talk a little bit about future work, apart from what I've implicated. An important issue here is right now what we're doing obviously violates Lorentz invariance, okay? These equations that we have a lattice on them, and they're not Lorentz invariant. And we know that's not acceptable. If you violate Lorentz invariance, even by a small amount, as soon as you turn on interactions in your matter, you get catastrophically bad corrections that are inconsistent with experience. So something will have to be done about that. So we did some sketches of what one could do, and we found out that if you consider superpositions of backgrounds of different masses, and you restrict the types of matter fields that can be considered, you can end up with results that are Lorentz invariants, even though your quantum spacetime has a discrete structure. And there's some more details here. And also, Sabine Hossenfelder recently wrote in her blog about this. It's just first steps, and we're not arguing that this is a complete treatment or anything like that. As we argued, the finiteness introduced by the lattice opens hopes for back reaction calculations. Work is underway. But I urge people not to get too carried away with a Casimir calculation, because here there are two ingredients that conspire to make this, or one ingredient if you want, that conspires to make this calculation particularly clean. And it's the fact that you're taking a derivative, meaning you're taking a difference of two quantities. The two quantities you are computing, these energies, are enormous. Why? Well, because in the continuum, these things will all be divergent. Here, they're finite because you have a lattice. But your lattice is sub-Planckian in separation, meaning these quantities are huge. Okay. However, because you're computing a difference of them, miraculously, you get the correct physical result. Now, if you're going to do back reaction, you're going to have to deal with these quantities, not with differences of them. And therefore, potentially, that will lead to huge back reaction effects that are clearly not physical. So what will be needed is probably a finite renormalization of the fields. After all, what is renormalization? It's about doing your low energy physics, making your low energy physics independent of your very high energy physics degrees of freedom. Okay, your low energy physics should not depend on very high energy physics degrees of freedom. Here, what we're going to say is we're going to make our low energy physics independent of these finite but very large degrees of freedom that are Planckian in nature. Okay. The main problem with this is that the amount of renormalization you need depends on the state of your quantum spacetime, particularly on what separation you chose for the points in the spin network. And this is not what normally one finds in renormalization. Normally one has universality. So this fact that you're going to have to renormalize a different amount on each different background that you might choose is rather unsettling. And one possibility to deal with that is to consider a theory where there is no dependence on the separation of the vertices, like, for instance, if you consider conformal invariant theories. There is a simple theory, which is Brandt's Dickey theory with omega equals minus 3/2. that is conformally invariant, and whose solutions are all mapped one-to-one via conformal transformations to general relativity. So we're trying to explore if loop quantum gravity shouldn't be based on that theory rather than on GR in order to do away with this problem that one has a dependence on the background spacetime for the amount of renormalization one needs to do. Let me conclude here. So we can formulate quantum field theory in quantum spacetimes for fields on spherically symmetric gravity backgrounds. It approximates quantum field theory in curved spacetime very well, so there's nothing terribly surprising there. The discreteness naturally regularizes the physical quantities, opening the possibility of back reaction calculations. Hawking radiation can be computed, and the result coincides with heuristic results that existed in the literature. The Casimir effect can be computed, and the right dependence on the separation and the right numerical factors are obtained. The background results are being generalized to the charge case, opening new perspectives on the Cauchy horizon instabilities. Self-gravitating shells have been studied on the quantum spacetime, again opening the possibility of back reaction calculations. Thank you very much.
We have some time for questions.
So you did shells. Do you think there's a possibility of doing something like collapsing dust?
What's the name of the solution?
Oppenheimer-Snyder? Or maybe Vaija, collapsing light or something?
The collapsing dust, of course, you open the question, what do you mean by a quantum dust, right?
That's right.
So we have looked at it, and there is that question. We thought this is simpler. And we have to be able to get further, and we're there, not there yet with this, so I think we're going to keep on concentrating on this at the moment.
But what about photons, though, Vaija?
We don't know how to make that, the constraint algebra of that, Lie algebra yet, and it might not be possible. We don't have a reason, a good deep reason, why it happened that in all these models, by restructuring the constraints, we could turn it into a Lie algebra. There's no understanding of why that is the case. So we go model by model, essentially. Yeah.
Can you comment on Planck stars?
Planck stars. The Scardo thing.
Yeah.
So Planck stars, the only thing that we can connect to is a very weak point of all this. So let me, if I have time, let me expand a little bit. So the answer is going to be wishy-washy and not very good, but it's what we got. So Planck stars, we seem to contradict Planck stars. Our shells just come in, go through a singularity to some other place. They don't bounce. They don't stop. None of those arguments heuristically that Carlo came up with seem to be implemented here.
So this looks like they're the universe.
Sorry?
Like baby universe.
Yes. So it doesn't seem to support what they're doing. But I urge you caution, because this is a weak part of the calculation. Namely, the reason the shells go through and keep going is because I assume there's a topology from the beginning that allows that to do, because canonical theory does not deal well with changes of topologies. And their arguments are all about that, are all when the black hole is about to form, this ought to bounce based on some heuristics, okay? And what I'm saying is canonical theory seems to be agnostic about that, doesn't know how to treat the case of a changing topology. So the answer is inconclusive.
To go back to the beginning, you say you have the constraints, the formally algebra.
Yes.
You don't really solve the difficult scale.
A group average. It's
in group average, but right. Is it in some sense is the difficult constraint satisfied?
In the usual sense of group averaging, there isn't an operator associated with it anymore, right?
It's a usual sense which I don't understand the agreements.
Okay.
I'm so asking
you won't understand our agreements either.
So, you know, because I'm concerned that, like, this huge space might have something to do with it.
It could be.
It's the same.
But you realize that it's exactly the same in the full case. I don't have anything to add here.
Yeah, maybe second question, which is maybe to comment on you more on this Lorentz violation, because one would maybe
I would have had always the hope solving the Hamiltonian constraints gives you some notion of nuance, of Lorentz symmetry.
Right, but see what we're doing here. We're doing that for the background spacetime. That I'm studying a quantum field living on it. And there's nothing that will restore Lorentz symmetry, right? It's like quantum field theory in curved spacetime, right?
Yeah. So you say that it's more an effective treatment, or you do couple fully with the quantum field?
It doesn't back react yet.
It doesn't back react.
Right. So we're trying to study if you want a certain limit of loop quantum gravity, which would touch quantum field theory in curved spacetime. Okay, Raphael had a question.
I had two actually. One was on the Lorentz invariant, so one was on the renormalization. On the Lorentz invariant, can you say a little more what this, with Udolpho, you had some sort of proposal? The problem, it sounds like you want to make some superposition of different lattices.
Yeah, we do superposition of lattices, and we also introduce non-local interactions on the scalar field.
I see.
That sort of cuts off you have to go through the whole argument. The whole argument is
nothing wrong with free field theories yet, but once you turn on interactions, there is this paper of Sudarsky, Urrutia, Vucetich, et cetera, where they show that due to the fact that when you turn on interactions on your fields, you have loop integrals, and the loop integrals are unbounded in energy, even if you have tiny Lorentz violations like we have here, in those integrals you touch them because the integrals go up to infinity. And so if you find a way of cutting off those integrals, for instance, introducing a non-local interaction for your field, then that problem can be bypassed. And the type of non-local interactions...
The Lorentz breaking infecting the other fields so that the light bounds don't match and so on. Is that the problem you're referring to?
No, the problem I'm referring to is that when you have interacting quantum fields, you have loop integrals in your fields, and those integrals go from zero to infinity. And even if you have a tiny Lorentz violation in your propagator, that infinity will bring it up.
Yeah, I think it's the same.
Okay.
But then, there was a paper, I don't know if you know, by Joe Henson, where he tried to carefully argue that there's no way of making, I think roughly what you're doing is making a superposition of different lattices, hoping that it'll restore Lorentz invariance. But the problem seems to be with the non-compactness of the Lorentz, so that you need...
Correct. That's what we throw in the second ingredient, which are non-local interactions.
You may be able to...
Sorry?
You're saying the non-locality might be able to
right.
deal with this?
Right.
Can you say a little more about
it? Basically, the non-local interactions, when you translate them into these integrals or the propagator, cut off the integrals for large values of momenta and make the effect sort of manageable.
So would it mean you'd be end up with a small breaking of Lorentz invariants in your particular frame? And then presumably there's some upper limit to boost that you could do beyond which
correct.
You would see order one breaking apart.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm okay with having limits of boosts because if you boost to sort of sub-Planckian energies, then of course you're going to see things. So I think that's fine. And you had a second one you said?
Well, about the renormalization, can you say a little more about, what's the physical basis of the renormalization? Normally in the continuum it's sort of done without giving any physical basis to it, but one picture that you're subtracting off a very large zero-point energy, for example, in this case.
Right.
One picture that people may have, but there's some other fields that compensate that, we don't understand what they are, but it's enough to know that they're there, and then somehow, as you said, they're the effect on the law of the large scale physics is small or encoded in just one or two, a finite number of parameters.
Right.
What would be, is that the physical picture you would have? What would be your reason for, now everything is finite, what would be your reason for canceling out the zero-point energy, for example?
Again, saying in the same sense that when you work with effective field theories, you separate things at different tiers of energy, and you say that your low energy physics shouldn't depend on high energy degrees of freedom, if you adopt that point of view here, and why not? After all, we're not doing full quantum gravity here. We're doing a quantum field on a quantum spacetime. So it's very much akin to a quantum field on a classical spacetime. There are some differences, but the point of view, I think, one can take the same.
But then in that point of view, you're not even asking about the microscopic physics. You're just saying, let's formulate an effective theory for large scale physics.
Right, and so I'm trying to formulate it.
But if you,
and when I do,
what's the point of putting lattice at the Lorentz, at the Planck scale or something like
that? I don't put it, it comes out. That's an important difference.
Okay, but yes, but then what's the point of looking at it? If your point of view is effective field theory, then there's no reason to look at the microscopic physics.
Correct. So I'm trying
so
to make
you want to look at the microscopic physics, but then you need to, don't you need to fill in the story by some way that interpolates for us between the microscopic physics?
Yes.
So in other words, you need a more concrete or a more physical story about the renormalization.
There's full quantum gravity here. There's quantum field theory in curved space-time here. Yeah. And we have now quantum field theory on quantum space-time here. This one presumably will answer all your questions.
This one we still have to fill some in by hand in the blanks, but at least we're closer to make contact with this other one, whereas in the full theory, we're completely lost in terms of making contact with quantum field theory in curved space-time, right?
Your point of view is something like the full quantum gravity will take care of this.
Right.
So that when we come up to the intermediate.
Well, hopefully, yes.
I mean, one hopes.
Yeah.
When we come up to the intermediate regime, then the zero-point energies aren't really there.
Right. But at the moment, as
and
we're doing
you said
it,
something there are, about there's a higher degree of sensitivity here to the background than there would be in ordinary renormalization. Can you? I didn't understand that. Does it mean that the long distance theory that you get it actually depends?
Right, I have
many details on what you.
I can find a zillion different lattices that all approximate very well your classical spacetime,
yeah,
but that have different spacings,
yeah,
and I'm going to have to renormalize a different amount for each of them.
But isn't that the usual story?
No, if I give you like a given sort of background classical spacetime, you do one renormalization, that's it. Now you give me one classic.
Because the lattice is
state dependent,
which is not.
Right.
So the lattice is state dependent.
The renormalization has a state dependence, which it didn't have.
Right, which is given by the separation of the points in the spin network primarily.
So does it mean that you don't have a well-defined long-distance theory? Or what does it mean? How would that arbitrariness show up in this?
Yeah, that's why I don't want to do it that way, because of these type of objections. That's why I'm arguing that perhaps the underlying theory should be independent of the separation of the spin networks, and therefore you have one correction for all, and that's it.
But I haven't understood exactly. Suppose you tried to do it that wrong-headed way that you just said.
It would be very.
What would happen? You wouldn't have any effective theory, or it would have an infinite number of free parameters in it?
Right.
So you'll
have to be choosing the amount of renormalization per background state. That's not very natural, I think.
And if
to be fair, this is work in progress.
Yeah.
So we.
Yeah.
And if you study.
Except that I don't see much of a way out of that if you do it this way, apart from modifying the background theory to make it independent of the separation of the points.
And if you study something like semi-classical states for the coupled system of matter and geometry.
Yeah, we haven't done that.
But do you expect that these are like generic, that these should be superpositions of like lattices with different valency, so that you?
Oh no! Generically, even here we have superpositions with different valences. You don't have to have a single lattice.
Okay. So
Generically, it's simpler to describe things in terms of one lattice, but in general, you would superpose. There's no reason why not to.
That question is more to the extent how we can understand the stuff as something on fixed or semi-fixed methods and to compare maybe with discussions Jacobson has done and other people. for instance, if you have a field propagating on a lattice, you know, then the dispersion relation is different, and then there's some crazy processes like the flood process, which I want to do with this Plotkin problem. So can you shed light on this? What happens with this?
To begin with, as I mentioned, the separation of the points is really sub-Planckian. So those effects really happen for modes that are incredibly short length. So that is different than the usual picture people have in mind, where separation of the points is Planckian, and therefore just at the Planck scale physics, you have all these processes going on. Here they would happen at much higher energies than the Planckian. So that's one attitude you can take. They're not nice, but they're strange because they're extremely high energy, right, even beyond quantum gravity.
Just one more question. So you said that for if you consider a certain combination of the Hamiltonian and the vector constraints, and for certain choices of lumps and shifts,
yes,
the algebra becomes abelian.
Not for certain choices of lumps and shifts. You can redefine the lumps and shifts, or redefine the constraints,
okay,
same thing, such that the
Hamiltonian becomes abelian.
So
and Hamilton will diffuse the usual.
So it's not for a certain, so the laps and shift, they're still arbitrary.
The laps and shift are arbitrary. And again, it's for certain models, and we don't understand any underlying reason why this happened.
So you still have infinitely many constraints.
Yes.
Quite possibly you covered this before I came in, so don't answer it now if that's the case. I'll ask you that later. But what is it, what dimensional quantity in your theory, or what dimensionless quantity is allowing you to get very small sub-Planckian scales in the lattice space? And the naive size of the lattice would be Planckian.
Right, so it's Planck squared divided by mass of a black hole.
This is the same thing, the dependence of the lattice
right on
the background state.
Right, and this is given by the condition of the quantization of the areas of symmetry.
From one to the next, there's a minimum jump you can have, and it's given by that, L Planck squared divided by n.
Is this like the mu bar scheme?
No.
No.
This is so everything here is mu zero at the moment.
It's very extreme dependent on the background.
It is.
The scale of the lattice depends on
what
background you're thinking of.
Well, you choose the lattice. You choose the vacuum state. What I'm saying is there is a limit to what you can do. You can't go smaller than that.
But you could go larger.
Oh, yeah. You can choose any state you want.
No, I mean for the lattice. But once you choose the state,
the lattice. What you're missing is that the choice of the lattice is part of the choice of the state.
Right.
This is quantum gravity.
Okay, but then if on a large scale it's something like a black hole, then you're saying the lattice is forced to be very small sub-Planck?
No, you can choose it to be very small.
That's what I don't understand. How can change, if you change the state dramatically, doesn't that mean you don't have a black hole anymore, or you have a different size?
No, the only thing it does is it approximates the continuum better,
so to speak. In order to approximate a continuum as good as you want the smallest lattice possible, think numerical relativity, say. The only thing we're saying here is there's a limit to how small you can go, but that limit is way below sort of Planckian.
So along the lines of what Lee was saying, are you saying that if naively I just have a black hole, that there are actually many different quantum states that correspond to that?
Right.
And some of them have a very small lattice spacing, sub-Planckian. Some of them might have a Planck scale lattice spacing.
Yes.
Some might even have a super Planck.
Some might have a kilometer lattice spacing.
But those are not going to approximate very well the space time.
Like
right.
But then it's because you don't know enough about the dynamics to see which one is really picked out by nature.
Correct.
Is that a fair statement?
We're looking at a general black hole, and therefore there's no real dynamics. This wasn't formed in a class.
No, but I mean,
is there
some, so to speak, ground state or approximate ground state for that, then
hopefully
you expect to see things about this. Our physical intuition would say that if you choose the wrong state, then it'll kind of evolve to the ground state, maybe radiate away stuff.
Correct. We're far away from treating that.
Then you need to understand what that is.
Collapse much better. So supposedly, when you collapse something, it will pick for you one of these states. I wouldn't be as arbitrary as I'm making it sound right now. It is because we're just looking at an internal black hole.
Or even if it's time with an internal, quote-unquote, well, it's still going to evolve. Unless you impose...
If it's eternal, you can't evolve. So.
The linguistic, but the answer is that it's not forced on you to have very subplots.
No.
But it's a possibility.
Right.
Is there another, maybe some other question? Otherwise, I would say we thank the speaker.
Thank you.